should I finish behind Nancy Dahlstrom in the primary, I will step out of the race. And I would hope that others on the right side of the aisle would do the same.
Nick Begich says he'd drop out of the race for Congress if he doesn't lead the primary, but not all candidates agree with his strategy. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, lawmakers consider changing residency requirements for hunting and fishing licenses.
They're a citizen when it's convenient for them. And, you know, that's not okay.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Conservatives hoping to defeat Congresswoman Mary Peltola in November dread a replay of what happened last time. In 2022, Republican candidates Nick Begich and Sarah Palin spent most of their campaign energy attacking each other, right up to the general election, and Republican voters were split between the two. Now, Begich is making a pledge that he says could prevent a similar split this year. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
As Begich and a lot of other Republicans see it, Alaska's open primary is a problem. The top four candidates of any party advance to the general election. This year, that might mean that Begich and fellow Republican Nancy Dahlstrom would compete against each other as well as against the incumbent. So here's Begich's pledge.
Should I finish behind Nancy Dahlstrom in the primary, I will step out of the race. And I would hope that others on the right side of the aisle would do the same.
If other Republicans would make the same pledge to drop out, it could effectively create a closed Republican primary. Then Begich says GOP voters could line up behind a single candidate. Another way Republicans could avoid a split would be to make use of ranked choice voting. But Begich says his way has more appeal to Republican voters.
For those who are not a fan of ranked choice voting, and I consider myself one of those people, we can self-impose a primary among the Republicans if we make that commitment.
But why would you want to do that?
Julie Lucky leads Alaskans for Better Elections, which defends ranked choice, open primaries, and the other parts of the voting system Alaskans adopted in 2020. Lucky says there's nothing wrong with Begich's pledge, but she says dropping out after the primary would leave his fans with fewer options.
I think that his supporters should be able to say, if I had my choice, this is the person I would choose. But if that person doesn't make it past that 50%, or if no candidate makes it past that 50%, right, this is the person I would choose second.
Many ranked choice opponents feel that Peltola only won because Republicans were split. If you add the votes of the two Republicans together, they got 2,000 more first-round votes than Peltola did. Peltola got just under 49% of the first-choice votes, and combined, the two Republicans got just over 49%. But Lucky says combining the Republican vote doesn't tell the real story of how those voters felt. She points out that thousands of Begich voters ranked Peltola as their second choice.
What we saw is that the electorate is very complex, and we saw a lot of combinations where somebody would rank somebody first, and then their second choice might not be somebody that you would think would be their second choice, because I think that voters are complex, and the system allows them to express that.
In any case, Dahlstrom isn't making a pledge to drop out if she finishes behind Begich in the primary. While Begich has a lot of support from Republican leaders in-state, Dahlstrom has the support of several national Republican powerhouses, notably House Speaker Mike Johnson. The speaker's videotaped endorsement played at the Alaska Republican Convention last weekend.
Winning Alaska is our top priority, and the person to flip this seat is Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom.
A spokesman for the Dahlstrom campaign says she's focused on beating Peltola in November. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Alaska Senate passed a bill today to tighten residency requirements on hunting and fishing licenses. If it becomes law, only Alaskans who qualify for a permanent fund dividend would be eligible for a resident license. Wildlife troopers say it would close a loophole that makes it difficult to prosecute people who claim residency but do not spend most of their time in the state. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
Kurt Whitehead lives in Klawock on Prince of Wales Island, and he says every summer as the humpbacks and herring and salmon return, so too do the island's seasonal residents.
They're basically tourists. You could be nice and call them seasonal residents, but really they only come to our state just for the hunting and the fishing, and sometimes they stay as little as 1 week, and sometimes they stay as much as maybe 4 or 5 months. But their whole intent is just to harvest as much as possible.
Unlike most tourists, they're able to buy fishing and hunting licenses reserved for residents. Whitehead says that's because of the state's eligibility requirements. Once you're in Alaska for a year, basically all you have to do is keep a home in the state, plan to come back, and not claim residency anywhere else.
Some of them do have homes, but there's a large majority of them that just have an RV parked on somebody's lot.
A deputy director of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers told a House committee earlier this year that the loose definition of residency makes it difficult for officials to prosecute people who take advantage. Resident licenses typically have higher daily catch limits and allow folks to participate in resident-only personal use fisheries, like dip netting on the Copper or Kenai Rivers. Or take king salmon. In Southeast, non-residents are limited to between 1 and 3 kings a year, but residents this summer can catch 2 per day. Resident licenses are also a lot cheaper, often 4 or 5 times less expensive than what non-residents pay. Whitehead sits on several state-sponsored fish and game advisory committees for Prince of Wales Island communities, and he's been pushing lawmakers to pass a bill that would eliminate the residency loophole. It would tie residency to PFD eligibility, and that means in most cases you can't leave the state for more than 180 days during the year. There are some exceptions for people in the military and college students and some others, though there's some debate about how consistently those are applied in practice. Clinton Cook leads the Craig Tribal Association, not too far from Klawock on Prince of Wales Island, and he says people who spend most of their time out of state shouldn't benefit from the breaks the state cuts for its residents.
They're a citizen when it's convenient for them, and, you know, that's not okay.
Tribes, fish and game committees, and municipalities from around the state submitted letters in support of the bill. Nikiski Republican Senator Jesse Bjorkman sponsored it in the Senate.
When people who do not live permanently in Alaska capitalize on fish and game laws meant for residents, they diminish harvest opportunities for year-round residents, the people who shovel snow and stick it out throughout the entire course of the year in our great state.
Senator Mike Schauer, a Wasilla Republican, said he's concerned it could exclude some retirees who leave Alaska for extended periods despite a long history in the state.
There are some concerns from a number of individuals about what this may impact, especially in those that may leave the state for the wintertime, which a lot of us do as you get older, go out and visit family and things like that.
He said he was concerned that it could violate the Alaska Constitution's guarantee of equal access to fish and game resources. The Senate ultimately passed the bill 15-5. It now heads to the House, where its prospects are unclear. Lawmakers have just about 3 weeks until all legislation dies at the end of the regular session. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
A group of Fairbanks parents recently held a press conference to share concerns about Governor Mike Dunleavy's stance on education funding. KUAC's Robin reports.
Elementary school parent Christina Terman visited the state capitol last month to advocate for more education funding, and the legislature subsequently passed a bill with an increase, but Governor Dunleavy vetoed it.
I was so frustrated reading some of the most recent press releases from our governor. So I was getting ready to write a letter to the editor as kind of a response. And then sort of jokingly, some friends and I were talking like, well, why don't you just have your own press conference? And one thing led to another. And I was like, why not? So we're just hoping maybe he'll actually listen.
Representatives for Governor Dunleavy's Fairbanks office were in the room at Joy Community Center for Wednesday's event. Among invited speakers, Sharon Hansen, who volunteers at her kids' charter school, says they have cut supplies, left positions unfilled, and increased class sizes due to flat funding from the state. Hansen said charter schools, like neighborhood schools, need a permanent increase in the amount of money the state gives.
One-time funds outside of the base student allocation are not guaranteed to be equally distributed to charters. This happened just this past year in Fairbanks with the one-time money given from the legislature.
Another parent who spoke, Jomo Stewart, was critical of the required local contribution, or RLC, that requires incorporated municipalities like the Fairbanks North Star Borough to help fund their schools. He said it works against local taxpayers.
Our own tax contributions relative to our school district lead to a reduction in the amount of support we get from the state.
He said the legislature and the governor need to change the state school funding formula.
We are going to keep having this challenge until we deal up the permanent fund and how its revenues are applied within our state to fund services.
The group also discussed Governor Dunleavy's push for more charter schools as a means to improving education, an assertion the numbers don't support, according to statistician Beth Zerbis, a Fairbanks parent and AP math teacher. Zerbis spent 50 hours this week examining data on schools in Alaska, looking for proof that charter schools are better than neighborhood schools.
We cannot conclude that charter schools are causing the performance differences we observe between them and neighborhood schools.
She said only 7% of Alaska students attend charter schools, and most of them skew wealthier in socioeconomic status, with greater parent involvement and more resources for students at home.
The claim that approaches used by Alaskan charters are especially beneficial to lower-income students is not very well supported.
A new education funding bill contains more of Dunleavy's requirements, including moving charter school approval authority from local school boards to the State Board of Education, which the governor appoints. House Bill 392 advanced from the House Education Committee this week and is headed to House Finance. It also puts back the $680 increase to the base student allocation that was in the bill Dunleavy vetoed last month. If it passes and is signed by the governor, it would mean about $8 million more for the Fairbanks North Scarborough School District. The parent group is posting recordings of the event on social media and sending a copy to the governor's office. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students from Nunam Ikwa continue their dominance of the Yupik Spelling Bee.
To be here and watching my daughter, I cannot express how it makes me feel. I'm proud of her.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Anchorage police are investigating three deaths after officers responded to two separate calls Thursday morning. Police say they were first notified early Thursday that a person had been brought to a local hospital, then died. In a brief statement, police said officers made observations that prompted them to take a closer look at the death, including examining a Northeast Anchorage home. Hours later, police were called to another home, this one in the Jewel Lake area. Police say officers found a man and a woman dead there. Police say both cases appear to be isolated incidents with no greater public safety concern. Police have not yet identified any of the people involved and declined today to discuss details of the investigations. The state medical examiner's office is still determining how all three people died. The state of Alaska is appealing a decision that brought back a personal watercraft ban in Kachemak Bay waters. KBBI's Jamie Deep has more on the appeals process and what this means for jet ski use in the bay now.
The ban originally went into effect in 2001 and prohibited all personal watercraft, commonly known as jet skis, from going into the Kachemak Bay and Fox River Flats critical habitat areas. These areas include all of the waters in Kachemak Bay, as well as the mudflats and marshlands at the head of the bay. The Department of Fish and Game repealed the ban in 2021, which led to Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang being sued by four organizations. The judge ruled that Vincent Lang did not have the authority to repeal the regulation in November, and the ban went back in place. Last month, the state filed an appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court to reverse the decision and send it back to a lower court. Kachemak Bay Conservation Society was one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Penelope Haas is the organization's vice president and is concerned about the potential amount of money the state will spend on the lawsuit and appeal.
It is concerning to us to observe the kind of inordinate amount of money the state seems to be spending on this litigation when their case really feels quite weak. They're spending Alaskan taxpayers' money to fight the ruling by the judge that is actually very cut and dry.
Haas says their attorneys estimate that this case could cost the state as much as $500,000. After denying the state's motion for reconsideration, the Superior Court issued a final judgment in February. However, the state filed a motion for a stay on putting the ban back in place, as well as notifying the public of the change. A stay temporarily stops illegal action from going through. Last month, the stay was partially granted. The state doesn't have to follow its public notice process, but the ban must stay in effect. While the ban is back in place, Haas says to report personal watercraft that go into Kachemak Bay.
If folks see jet skis in the bay, if they see them launching in the harbor or they see them running around out there, they should call the Alaska State Troopers.
Since the ban has been reinstated, Alaska State Troopers haven't received any reports of personal watercraft in the bay. But Alaska State Park Ranger Jason Oakley said in an email he made note of seeing two of them last month. As the case continues, the Supreme Court will hear from both parties and determine whether to uphold the ban or reverse the judge's decision. In Homer, I'm Jamie Deep.
A Fish Passage restoration project will soon bring improvements to the movement and health of a southern Kenai Peninsula salmon population. The Kenai Peninsula Borough and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently entered into a partnership to complete the restoration work. KDLL's Hunter Morrison has more on the project.
In February, the borough announced plans to redesign and replace two Fish Passage culverts off of borough-maintained Oil Well Road in Ninilchik. The area, which is part of the Deep Creek watershed, is home to a number of fish populations, including salmon and Dolly Varden. The Fish and Wildlife Service put together a project proposal and received over $1.3 million from the 2023 Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. The borough also appropriated $50,000 from Road Service Area Funds.
We must have wrote a compelling story about, locally, the need, obviously, to ensure that salmon can move freely.
This is Kyle Graham, a biologist with Fish and Wildlife, who's working on the project.
You know, emphasize like, hey, we're working with tribes and local government to, you know, kind of match the federal monies with the right locations.
Fish and Wildlife has worked closely with the Ninilchik Native Association on several improvement projects within the corporation's 70,000 acres of land surrounding the Ninilchik and Kisilof rivers. Association President and CEO Greg Insuleski says the area has lost much of its salmon population. The organization is now purchasing troll-caught salmon from Southeast Alaska.
And our people have always ate king salmons and silvers, and so we've lost both of that. Fish Passage is so important because of the sustainability of the stock and the rearing.
The replacement culverts are located within two tributary streams that connect to the larger watershed. Streams are important to salmon fry, as they provide optimal rearing habitat.
Our people have lived off of fish from time immemorial, and you know, it's actually, a lot of people say it's in our DNA, and I believe it is, but it's a very spiritual thing to us, too. Our health depends on healthy fish and good fish to survive.
Graham says another motivation for the project is a past flood that blew out a fish culvert in the watershed. He says after the flood, FEMA would only replace the culvert using the original design that was damaged.
We're incorporating a design that is way better for fish, and it's improves the infrastructure, and ultimately, like for the Ninilchik folks, it, you know, creates like safe and efficient access to subsistence resources. And not having to be concerned that, you know, when there's a big flood or whatever the future holds, that a crossing is going to wash out.
The project will soon go through a design process, and construction will likely begin in late 2025 or early 2026. Graham hopes the project will benefit salmon, the borough, and the Native Association. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Amazon's new facility in Anchorage is speeding up delivery times in Alaska, according to the online retail giant. The ground delivery station opened in November, and since then, delivery times have been cut in half, says Amazon spokeswoman Leanne Gullett.
But that's going to continue to speed up and improve as we move towards that 100% operational state.
The ground delivery station is the first in Alaska, and it's the last stop before packages are delivered to customers. Gullett says the facility is still in a ramp-up period and they're hiring. There's a particular need for what's called a delivery service partner owner, or DSP. Amazon delivery vans are not operated by Amazon. Instead, DSP owners are responsible for delivering packages, managing a fleet of vehicles, and hiring employees. Tomas Komuvez is a senior business development manager with the program. He says DSP owners typically manage up to 30 routes and 50 employees. He says they're looking to hire in the Anchorage area because there's been a significant increase in orders.
In the state of Alaska, this is kind of our last frontier in many ways. We will be looking to expand the DSP program further out to some other locations as well.
He says the Anchorage warehouse delivered their millionth package earlier this month. Nunam Ikwa in the Yupik language means land's end, a place on the Bering Sea coast that is so flat it's hard to tell where the land meets the sea. But when it comes to spelling, this community stands tall. Once again, the champion for this year's statewide Yupik Spelling Bee hails from Nunam Ikwa. After a dozen years, the annual statewide tournament is going strong. About two dozen students took part. KNBA's Rhonda McBride was there and has this story.
Please keep to yourselves and be quiet.
Spelling bees aren't the best of spectator sports, but families and coaches filled about 50 seats in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Acceleration Building with lots of cell phone cameras ready to roll.
I'm happy for the students, nervous at the same time, and I have butterflies in my stomach.
Although Marina Barner can't cheer out loud, she's here to support a student from Bethel. And like everyone else in this room, she has to keep quiet to help the students concentrate. But that sense of pride they feel speaks volumes.
To be here and watching my daughter, I cannot express how it makes me feel. I'm proud of her.
Thomas Carl's daughter Megan is only a fifth grader, but like the rest of the kids here, she is a shining star of hope in her community to keep the Yupik language, or Yuktun, alive.
Tukanaha, your word. Ilini.
This year, there's new competition from the Lower Yukon School District, which added two new teams in addition to its award-winning Nunam Ikwa School.
Well, we saw the benefits. They felt that they were becoming stronger with their identities.
Janet Johnson directs the Yupik Language and Culture Program for the Lower Yukon District. She says preparation for the spelling bee helps the students become more comfortable as they learn to read and write in Yuktun. And that isn't easy when you speak a language that, until about 60 years ago, was almost never written, only spoken, and had to borrow from an English alphabet that really isn't suited for the sounds of Yuktun.
Gilak. Q-I-L-A-K. Gilak.
Gilak means sky. One of many new words that Essie Beck has learned in her job as principal at the Alakanuk School. Although she's from Alabama, she can vouch that spelling in Yuktun is definitely different than in English.
Oh, harder words, apostrophe, the dashes, the brackets, everything. It's a lot more challenging.
I have a question. What do you call that, like that curve on top of the letter?
That's called a ligature, which marks how two letters are rolled into one to produce a sound that's not in English.
Auha, A ligature U G apostrophe A, auha.
Auha. It means to take off. A short word, but there are a lot of long words in the mix because Yuktun is what linguists call a polysynthetic language in which one word can represent an entire sentence in English.
Angyongtuk, A-N-G-Y-A-N-G. Q-E-R-T-U-Q, Angyongtuk.
13 letters to say he has a boat. The judge signals when a speller gets a word wrong by saying
Koyan,
which means thank you. But sometimes it takes about 8 different contestants to arrive at the correct spelling and be rewarded with this word.
Asiktuk.
Asiktuk, which means it's good. And win or lose, it's all good for students like Ian Aguiar, a 7th grader from Alakanuk.
You get to learn new things, period. It's a new experience to everybody.
They're awesome, the way their brains can connect it.
Samantha Afghan coached this year's champion, Kirsten Manumik, a 7th grader, as well as Jalen Strongheart, a 5th grader who finished 3rd. They spent hours each week to prepare for the competition, and one of the carrots, a trip to to Anchorage.
You should hear the kids while we're driving around.
Oh, look at that car. Oh, look at that truck. Oh, look at that tree.
Excitement for students who live in a land where there's not so much as a hill. This year's competition also included an Inupiaq spelling bee with two students. Oh, and this is not something you'll find in an English spelling bee, a dance group that performs a song called The Polar Bear Shake to celebrate. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Chris Clint, Ava White, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, Robin in Fairbanks, Jamie Deep in Homer, and Hunter Morrison in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.